Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America, designed for people like you who are learning American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. Every day of the year on this program, we bring you news from and about the United States and the world. Because this program is produced for learners of American English, like you, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words and phrases that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. This is what you will hear on today's program. In our weekly higher education report, correspondent Pete Musto will tell us about several recent studies that show college students in the United States do not fairly judge their professors. Then, you will hear Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs. This week, Ana Mateo will tell us about American English expressions related to love gone wrong. And finally, as we do every Sunday, we will present The Making of a Nation. Today, we will tell the story of our 39th president, Jimmy Carter. He served just one term before being defeated by Ronald Reagan in 1980. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. So let's get started. Here's higher education correspondent Pete Musto.
At the end of a period of study, almost every university in the United States asks its students to evaluate their professors. This often happens before the students know how well they performed in their classes. Schools ask students about the teaching abilities of their professors and the usefulness of the material covered in the class. Administrators use this information to help make decisions about a professor's value to the school.
Universities rarely share this information with students. But students want information about teachers they have yet to take a class with. How difficult are the classes this professor teaches? How much time does that professor offer outside of class to help students? Does the professor use digital technology, like posting notes online? These are some of the kinds of questions students want answers to. So, in 1999, a computer programmer designed a website called Rate My Professors. The site let students from Canada, Britain, and the U.S. rate their professors on a scale of 1 to 5 in several areas. These areas included clarity, easiness, helpfulness, and overall quality. The site also let students rate the professor's physical appeal. As of December 2016, Rate My Professors listed about 17 million ratings of more than 1.6 million professors from over 7,000 schools. However, last May, the site removed clarity and helpfulness as individual qualities to be rated. Universities rarely, if ever, use Rate My Professors ratings as a way of evaluating the performance of the professor. Students may find them useful. However, this system of evaluation does present problems.
Andrew Rosen is a graduate student studying chemical engineering at Northwestern University outside of Chicago. He says he used Rate My Professors often in the past. He likes that students can list comments about professors to give more information than just a rating. But, Rosen says, he noticed a sharp gender disparity in such ratings. So, he designed a computer program to study the almost 8 million ratings of professors at U.S. universities. He says no one had ever done a study of this kind. The academic publication Assessment and Evaluation in Higher Education published the findings in January. Rosen looked at the differences in average overall quality scores between professors in different areas of study. He also looked at the differences in average overall quality scores between male and female professors.
So across all of the disciplines on the site, there's not one discipline where female professors score higher than male professors. And of course, by that, I don't mean to imply that female professors may not be as good professors as male professors. That's not true at all. What I do mean is that students that submit these reviews may have gender biases against or for certain professors.
Rosen says students may not realize they are consistently rating women lower than men. But he says the study shows that subconscious bias among students affects their judgment. And, he says, gender is not the only thing students are considering. Rosen found that professors with higher average scores for easy classes also had higher average overall quality scores. Overall quality scores were also higher for professors rated as good-looking. There were also major differences in how students view academic fields. Professors of mathematics and science often had lower ratings than those teaching art or language. For example, the average overall quality rating of physics professors is 3.4 out of 5. The average overall quality rating of foreign language professors is 4.
Rosen suggests this may be because professors in some fields have more experience in research than in teaching. But the rating process could also be affected by student expectations as to how professors of certain subjects should look and act.
Some disciplines probably have different gender stereotypes. The stereotypical image of a scientist is kind of like a white male in a lab coat with a beaker, right? So if you have a professor that doesn't fit that mold, perhaps these gender stereotypes are causing these differences.
Rate My Professors chose not to speak with VOA for this story. But other experts in higher education also argue these types of rating methods have problems.
I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now, here's Anna Mateo.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. On this program, we explore common expressions in American English. Today, we talk about expressions related to a very powerful emotion, love. More specifically, we talk about expressions related to love gone not quite right, relationships that do not work out, relationships that are more trouble than they are worth, and relationships that make you wish you were alone. After all, while some happy couples are celebrating Valentine's Day this month, plenty of other people have more complicated relationships. This show is for them. Our first expression may sound impossible. It is the love-hate relationship. Love and hate are opposites, but they are both strong emotions. In the case of a love-hate relationship, a couple just keeps going back and forth between the two feelings. One day they fight like cats and dogs, another day they sing together like lovebirds. You can also have a love-hate relationship with something besides another person. If you love some parts of your work but hate other parts of it, you can say you have a love-hate relationship with your job. Another expression that relates to opposing feelings is, there is a fine line between love and hate. A person can go very easily from loving to hating. Star-crossed lovers are very different than those in a love-hate relationship. These types of lovers want to be together, but everything seems to keep them apart, even the stars. This expression comes from the belief of some cultures that the stars control our futures. The Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary says star-crossed was first used in 1597. Probably the most famous star-crossed lovers are William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. Star-crossed lovers never seem to get together, so they are rarely on the rebound. A rebound relationship is the first relationship someone has after he or she has ended a serious long-term relationship. The term rebound used in this way dates back at least to the 1830s. Writer Mary Russell Mitford wrote, "Nothing so easy as catching a heart on the rebound." People on the rebound are easily hurt and vulnerable, so they often make bad decisions in choosing a new love interest. Instead of getting involved with someone else right away, someone on the rebound probably needs some time alone, as well as distance from their ex. Long distance. This time and distance alone to heal is not to be confused with a long-distance relationship. People in a long-distance relationship live very far apart from each other and don't see each other on a regular basis. A long-distance relationship can be perfect for someone who likes their own space, but it can be lonely for a person who wants to spend a lot of time day-to-day with their partner. A long-distance relationship can also be very expensive if the two people need to buy airplane tickets to see each other. Of course, every relationship has its ups and downs, good times and bad times. But a tumultuous relationship has very high ups and very low downs, even though a tumultuous relationship can be troubled or even violent. It appeals to some people who like passion and drama. But after a while, all that passion and drama can destroy the soft, gentle feelings the couple had toward each other. They eat away at the couple's love like poison, and the relationship turns toxic. And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
Thanks, Anna. Now we present The Making of a Nation. Steve Ember is here to tell the story of the 39th President of the United States, Jimmy Carter.
It is January 20th, 1977, Inauguration Day. America's newly elected president, Jimmy Carter, is on his way to the White House after his swearing-in ceremony at the Capitol building. But the new president is not riding in a car, he is walking. His wife, Rosalind, and his daughter, Amy, walk with him. Crowds along Pennsylvania Avenue cheer. Bands play. On this cold day in Washington, Americans look to the future. Watergate, the crisis that led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon, is several years in the past. The Vietnam War is history, too. Republican Gerald Ford served the remaining years of Nixon's term. Many people believe he brought respect and order back to the government. Yet he lost the office to Democrat Jimmy Carter in the election of 1976. The nation still has problems. Unemployment is high. So is inflation. But the future of the nation looks bright. Jimmy Carter feels sure about his future, too. On the day before his inauguration, he said,
I do feel that the people of this nation, and I think the entire world, wish me well and want to see me succeed as president. And that gives me a sense of reassurance and confidence. I think I'm ready now to be president.
During the election campaign, Carter often said he would be different from other presidents. He told voters he was not a member of the Washington political establishment, so he would do things in his own independent way. Carter was from Georgia, in the deep south of the United States. There had not been a president born in the South in more than 100 years. Carter studied nuclear engineering and attended the United States Naval Academy. He planned to stay in the Navy. Then his father died, and he decided to return to Georgia to operate the family peanut farm. Carter began his political life on the committee that supervised schools in his hometown of Plains, Georgia. He also served in other local offices. In 1966, he failed to win the Democratic nomination for governor of Georgia. For the next 4 years, he traveled around the state gathering support. He won the next election. As governor, Carter earned praise for reorganizing the state government. He also reformed state programs dealing with prisons and mental health care. In 1972, he offered himself as a candidate for vice president with presidential candidate George McGovern, but the Democratic Party chose someone else. Carter did not wait long to begin his next political move. He would try to win the Democratic presidential nomination in 1976. Jimmy Carter was hardly known outside the state of Georgia. Political experts gave him little chance. Even his mother was surprised to learn that he wanted to be president. President of what? She asked. But the farmer and former governor had a plan. He would try to win his party's primary elections in the South. He believed this would give him enough support at the party convention to win the nomination. Other Democratic candidates tried to stop him, but his plan worked. By the time of the convention, he had enough support to win the nomination on the first ballot. In the general election, Carter defeated President Ford by almost 2% of the popular vote. He lost in the West and Middle West, but won the South and Northeast. President Carter believed strongly in human rights. He hoped he could use his new position to support human rights throughout the world. On this and other issues, he was not afraid of being criticized when he believed he was right. For example, he believed it was right for the United States to end its control of the Panama Canal. He won congressional support for treaties to give control to Panama by the year 2000. He believed it was right to give diplomatic recognition to Communist China. And he believed it was right to continue negotiations with the Soviet Union about limiting nuclear weapons, even though he denounced human rights violations there. In 1979, Carter and Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev signed the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, known as SALT II. However, Carter decided not to send the treaty to the Senate for approval after the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan later that year. One of the finest moments of Carter's presidency took place at Camp David. That is the holiday home of American presidents. There, in March 1979, President Anwar Sadat of Egypt met with Prime Minister Menachem Begin of Israel. They signed a peace treaty ending 30 years of war between their countries.
We are privileged to witness tonight a significant achievement in the cause of peace, an achievement none thought possible a year ago, or even a month ago, an achievement that reflects the courage and wisdom of these two leaders.
Both men said the treaty would not have been possible without President Carter's help. President Carter was not as successful in dealing with the economy. High unemployment and inflation continued. The federal deficit increased, although he had promised to end it. And there was a shortage of gasoline. The shortage resulted when oil-producing countries limited production and exports. Carter urged American companies to develop new sources of energy in addition to oil. He said the United States needed to do this because it could not always depend on getting enough oil from other countries.
This intolerable dependence on foreign oil threatens our economic independence and the very security of our nation. The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never. From now on, Every new addition to our demand for energy will be met from our own production and our own conservation. The generation-long growth in our dependence on foreign oil will be stopped dead in its tracks right now.
During the gasoline shortage, Americans had to wait in long lines to buy fuel. They did not like it and were angry. Many were even more angry about a different situation. Like the gasoline shortage, it was a result of actions in another distant place.
Good evening. The U.S. Embassy in Tehran has been invaded and occupied by Iranian students. The Americans inside have been taken prisoner.
On November 4, 1979, Muslim extremists in Iran seized the American Embassy in Tehran. They took many hostages, including more than 60 Americans. The extremists said they were punishing the United States for being friendly with ousted Iranian leader Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The extremists refused to negotiate. They refused to release the hostages. In early April 1980, President Carter broke off diplomatic relations with Iran. He then ordered American military forces to try to rescue the hostages in Tehran. The operation failed. A sandstorm caused two of the aircraft to crash into each other. They went down in the desert hundreds of kilometers away. The failed rescue attempt had a major effect on the presidency of Jimmy Carter. Many Americans felt it showed that he could not do the job. Their respect for him continued to decrease as the hostages continued to be held. Other things were beginning to go wrong, too. The president's younger brother, Billy, admitted receiving a large amount of money from Libya. He took the money in exchange for supporting Libyan interests with American lawmakers. His mistake was that he did not list his name as a representative of a foreign government. ...1980 was a presidential election year in the United States. President Carter was expected to be the candidate of the Democratic Party, but his chances were almost ruined because of the situation in Iran. Carter hoped that concern for the hostages would unite the country behind him. Instead, support turned to blame. Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts believed he could defeat Carter for the nomination. Kennedy won several important Democratic primary elections. But that was not enough. The party renominated Carter. Kennedy offered Carter his support, but not very strongly. This left the party divided.
The Republicans got ready to win back the White House. They hoped to do it with a strong appeal to American voters. The appeal came from a man who would become one of America's most popular presidents, Ronald Reagan. That will be our story tomorrow, here on Learning English. You can find the entire Making of a Nation series online with transcripts, MP3s, and images at learningenglish.voanews.com. Well, that's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you, and has helped you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington. Thanks for spending some time with us today. I hope you'll join us tomorrow for another Learning English program from the Voice of America.